From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
A gigantic mushroom cloud of smoke rose into the sky, and shockwaves came and hit our building so strongly that the whole place shook, and I'm surprised the glass in the windows didn't break. We all started running down the stairs really fast.
Today, a report from Baghdad as the U.S. continues its massive bombing and casualties mount. We'll talk about prisoners of war, millions of people protest around the world. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Friday, the United States led the heaviest bombing assault that Baghdad has ever seen. Shock and awe was how the Pentagon described the overwhelming attack. The London Mirror newspaper described it as shocking and awful. During the campaign, the U.S. and Britain flew a combined 2,000 sorties and launched 1,000 cruise missiles that pummeled Baghdad, as well as the northern Iraqi cities of Mosul and Kirkuk, and Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit. The number of casualties are unknown. 2 days later, on Sunday, U.S. forces suffered what the Guardian of London described as the military's worst day since the Black Hawk Down debacle in Somalia a decade ago. On Sunday, 15 U.S. soldiers were killed, 14 were wounded, and 5 were taken prisoner of war. Video of the POWs appeared on the Arabic news station Al Jazeera. President Bush responded by saying those responsible for the mistreatment of POWs would be treated as war criminals. A day earlier, Bush warned the war in Iraq, quote, could be longer and more difficult than some have predicted. Today, he plans to tell congressional leaders the war in Iraq will cost about $80 billion. As U.S. forces race to Baghdad, Iraq's defense minister warned today that the U.S. would, quote, pay a heavy price in blood if they choose to fight in Baghdad. And President Saddam Hussein appeared on Iraqi national television to rally his troops and condemn the United States. His speech noted recent events, including the battle for Qasr. The International Committee of the Red Cross has warned a humanitarian crisis is looming in Iraq's second-largest city, Basra, following U.S.-led airstrikes on the strategic city. Iraqi officials say 77 civilians died in the attack. The Red Cross said the bombings destroyed electricity cables powering the local water station. The city's water and electricity have been cut off for more than 2 days. 3 missiles fired by U.S. jets landed in southwestern Iran. This, according to Iran's official IRNA news agency. Another rocket hit an oil refinery depot where 2 guards were injured, and the Pentagon has admitted 2 of its Tomahawk cruise missiles misfired and landed in Turkey. In another bombing mishap, a U.S. Patriot missile battery mistakenly shot down a British Air Force Tornado attack jet, killing 2 British pilots. Near the Syrian border, a U.S. missile hit a passenger bus carrying Syrian civilians fleeing the war in Iraq. 5 were killed, 10 were injured. And missing British TV reporter Terry Lloyd is believed to be dead after apparently coming under friendly fire in southern Iraq. In separate articles on Saturday, embedded reporters from CNN and the Sydney Morning Herald reported that the U.S. military is using napalm as part of its arsenal in Iraq. Although reports apparently vetted by military officials, the Pentagon quickly denied the use of napalm in Iraq. Relatives of one of the first U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq have lashed out at President Bush. A heartbroken father, Michael Watersby, cried in a televised interview as he clutched a photograph of his son, Kendall Damon Watersby, who died last week. He said, "Are you looking, George Bush? Are you looking? This was not your son or daughter. That chair he sat in at Thanksgiving will be empty forever." He continued, "I am against this war. I'm against killing for any reason." Kendall's sister, Nakia, later added, "This war is all about oil and money, but Bush has already got oil and money. It's about greed. He ought to send his daughters over there to fight." The Pentagon is downplaying reports that U.S. forces discovered a, quote, huge chemical weapons factory in central Iraq. A U.S. Army sergeant has taken into custody in Kuwait over the weekend after military officials charged he tried to blow up his own comrades at Camp Pennsylvania, located near the Kuwaiti border with Iraq. One soldier was killed and 15 were wounded after grenades were rolled into their tents. The man was identified as Asan Akbar of California, a member of the 326th Engineer Battalion of the 101st Airborne Division. And last week, a third State Department official resigned over the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Foreign envoy Mary Wright charged that U.S. foreign policies will make the world more dangerous, not safer. As the U.S. and coalition forces advance on Baghdad, millions of people around the world participated in demonstrations against the invasion. Some of the largest protests were staged in the United States. In New York, hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets. Marchers filled a 40 blocks long stretch of Broadway, sidewalk to sidewalk. Demonstrators said police used pepper spray and 90 arrests were made. Police report 13 officers were treated after being sprayed with an unknown substance. Nearly 20,000 people picketed outside CNN studios in Los Angeles and Atlanta, protesting the network's coverage of the war for its bias towards the U.S.-led invasion. And on Sunday night, anti-war protesters gathered outside the Kodak Theater in Los Angeles, where the Oscar ceremonies were held. Tens of thousands of people protested over the weekend in San Francisco. The city, which is already struggling with a $350 million budget shortfall, claims the protests are costing the city more than $900,000 a day. Spokespeople for the anti-war coalition International Action said the city should send the bill to the White House. More than 2,000 people have been arrested in anti-war demonstrations there since the invasion began. Seattle police arrested 14 people in a downtown anti-war protest that spilled onto the streets and tied up traffic. In Chicago, thousands of anti-war protesters exchanged angry words with a smaller group of 800 pro-war demonstrators. Veterans Against the Iraq War kicked off Operation Dire Distress with a conference in Washington on Saturday and a march on the Mall on Sunday. The group condemned the war in a statement that read, in part, "The present administration is led by men and women who chose not to go into the military and today have little understanding of war and no comprehension of its consequences." In San Juan, Puerto Rico, thousands, including the city's archbishop and several Korean War veterans, demonstrated against the war. In Baghdad, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi citizens protested the war and the policies of the invading countries, claiming to liberate them. Demonstrations were held throughout Britain over the weekend. 500,000 people turned out in London's Hyde Park on Saturday. Police put the estimate at around 200,000. Marchers were held at U.S. military bases in Gloucester and Yorkshire. Several thousand people also marched in Glasgow, Edinburgh, Aberdeen, and Manchester. Nearly 1 million people across Spain marched against the war. In Germany, there was a march on the U.S. Army's European command in Stuttgart. Thousands of Italians marched on a NATO airbase, while in Rome, activists draped a large black banner across the Colosseum. At least 25,000 people protested the war in Amsterdam. More than 6,000 people protested outside embassies in Brussels. Police and small numbers of black bloc protesters fought during a mostly peaceful demonstration of some 40,000 people in Bern, Switzerland. 40,000 Australians participated in the fourth day of protests in Sydney. The protest began with a prayer service by the city's Anglican dean, Philip Jensen, who called war hellish in its horror and destruction and hellish in its suffering. More than 100,000 people demonstrated in the eastern Pakistani city of Lahore. Protesters burnt an effigy of President Bush outside the U.S. mission in Jakarta, Indonesia. 8,000 people marched in Malaysia. 3,000 people gathered in Seoul, the capital of South Korea, to their government's decision to send up to 700 non-combatant troops to assist the war. The U.S. shut its embassies in Kenya, Nigeria, and South Africa. Protests were held throughout the African continent in cities like Mombasa and Mogadishu in Somalia. 1,000 people demonstrated outside the World Cup cricket finals in Johannesburg, and hundreds of riot police watched 5,000 students from Al-Azhar University in Cairo protest the war. You are listening to Democracy Now!
All right! Yeah!
Stop the War. Edwin Starr here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill, who's just returned from Baghdad, as we are about to talk about what is happening in Basra. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy. I just want to draw the attention of people to a website that was created for this attack by the United States. It's called IraqBodyCount.net. And what they're doing is compiling from media reports, similar to what Mark Harold did in Afghanistan, where he compiled all of the media reports on civilians that were killed or injured inside of Afghanistan during the U.S. attacks. Iraq Body Count today says that between 156 and 199 Iraqi civilians are confirmed dead.
Well, we are going to talk about civilian casualties right now. An interesting front page of the New York Times yesterday. Alessandra Stanley writes, television camera's usual route to battle is the trail left by its victims. Whether in Kosovo, Israel, Chechnya, or Afghanistan, combat is mostly conveyed by shots of a crowded refugee tent or a collapsed high-rise, a bloodied sidewalk, a full hospital ward, or an open grave. This time, the Pentagon took viewers on a thrilling ride-along with the warriors. Video phones, portable satellites, and night sight scopes brought the world a riveting display of American power. But it was a sanitized look, showing a little sweat, not blood and tears. Well, today we're going to try to find out what the picture is on the ground. The International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, said it's very concerned about the situation in the southern Iraqi city of Basra following the U.S.-led airstrikes on this strategic city. We have just reached on the telephone Nada Dumani, who is the press officer for the Middle East of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Nada Dumani.
Yes, hello.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us what you know at this point of what's happening on the ground in Basra? The Iraqi government is saying that 77 people have been killed there so far over the weekend.
Yes, unfortunately, we are not in a position to confirm or deny any of these reports. What we know for sure is that the situation is very, extremely preoccupying in Basra because of the shelling and the bombing that you've just mentioned. We have heard also that there were a lot of casualties. Unfortunately, also, the water system is not functioning anymore. We managed at the ICRC, to International Red Cross, to reestablish water for 40% of the population of the inhabitants of Basra, and we're very concerned that this situation might stay for a few coming days, and that would have a very dramatic impact on the civilian population.
Nada Dumani, what is the Basra is not a place that has generally had clean drinking water in the past. Do people have any access right now to water outside of that 40% that you mentioned?
Well, the 40% have access to water. In fact, it's just a makeshift solution. It's a temporary solution. Water has been brought since 2 days. We managed to bring the water from Shatt al-Arab River to get it to some of the suburbs of the city. Usually, Basra has clean water, drinkable water, coming from a main water station that is today a little bit far from the city, close to the airport, and that we cannot have access to it at the time being.
What chances that you're going to get access right now, and how are you communicating with the invasion force of the United States and Britain?
Well, we really hope we can have access as soon as possible, as I said, because the solution that was found so far is only a makeshift solution. It's only a temporary solution. So hopefully today or tomorrow, I don't know, we will be able. It all depends on the situation on the ground, the security condition, and the military operations.
How did the electrical and water supplies get shut down in Basra? Was it the direct result of a bombing?
Well, and for sure it's linked to the bombing. Now, I don't know how it was hit. The power failure is at the origin of the fact that the water station stopped functioning. It's called Wafa Alka. It stopped functioning because of a power failure, and the power failure is due that the cables have been hit by the bombing, and also electricity apparently has been run out from the city since yesterday. So it's all linked to the military operations.
Nada Dumani, any last words of the International Committee of the Red Cross to people in this country? Any last comment you'd like to make to people in this country and around the world who are listening?
We are very concerned, let's say, at the ICRC, that in this war, that at least all belligerents, all parties in conflict, stick to the rules of international humanitarian law, stick to the rule of the Geneva Conventions, and mainly respect of civilians and civilian properties, and also protection of prisoners of war from all sides.
Nada Doumani, press officer for the Middle East International Committee of the Red Cross, talking about the situation in Basra. Watching the television coverage throughout the weekend, I saw almost no mention of the number of Iraqi casualties on the ground in this very significant city. The Iraqi government is reporting something like 77 Iraqi civilians have been killed.
Al Jazeera has been showing nonstop footage from the hospital and from the street scenes in Basra, including a very young girl who had half of her head blown off.
Well, on Sunday, 15 American soldiers were killed, 14 were wounded, 5 were taken prisoner of war. Video of the POWs appeared on the Arabic news station Al Jazeera. President Bush responded by saying those responsible for the mistreatment of POWs would be treated as war criminals. Tony Blair condemned the Iraqi government for filming the prisoners, saying, quote, "Sometimes when people ask me, is it really necessary to get rid of Saddam? I say, look at the things he does. Parading people in that way is contrary to the Geneva Convention." War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld charged Iraq with breaching international conventions covering POWs. He said, quote, "It's illegal to do things to POWs that are humiliating to those prisoners." A day earlier, Bush warned that the war in Iraq could be longer and more difficult than some have predicted. We're joined right now by the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Welcome, Amy.
Can you start off by talking about this issue of prisoners of war and the Geneva Convention?
Well, when you pick up people in the battlefield, they're to be treated as prisoners of war. They're to be treated humanely, which means you can't do violence to them, that you can't really humiliate them. Putting them on TV arguably humiliates them. It doesn't specifically prohibit that in the conventions, but arguably it does. Of course, for the U.S. to complain about it is quite extraordinary here for a couple of reasons. First, even during this war, we've seen pictures of prisoners of war all over the TV. The New York Post today, for example, complained about the Iraqis, but has another picture of prisoners of war that the U.S. has taken. That's the first thing that I find amazing. The second thing, of course, is the utter hypocrisy of what the U.S. is saying. I represent the Guantanamo prisoners. First, we're not treating those people as prisoners of war. Secondly, we released photographs of those people, which were widely condemned. We did basically the same thing we're now accusing the Iraqis of. And thirdly, we've actually done physical violence to people that we've picked up on the battlefield. They've admitted they've exercised stress and duress tactics. So it's amazing to me now that the United States is now accusing Iraq, which claims it will be providing these people with prisoners of war status and treat them under the Geneva Conventions. It's amazing the United States is condemning the very conduct and much worse conduct that the United States has actually carried out on Guantanamo prisoners and others.
Also, we should say that it's unclear that the U.S. has taken Iraqi prisoners of war. The Iraqi information minister is saying that they've been dressing civilians up in military uniform, that the U.S. has been dressing them up in Iraqi military uniform and then staging these surrenders in the south of Iraq. Again, though, that's what Iraq is saying.
Again, we don't know. I mean, what you have to look at really is what's behind this. I mean, you know, I think what they got upset about, what the United States got upset about, was not the compliance with the Geneva Convention on this particular point, which compared to all the other points is relatively minor compared to all the other ways the U.S. has been treating prisoners of war. But it's really what is the United States really complaining about? They're complaining about the fact that U.S. prisoners were put on TV, and Americans see that and say, hey, maybe this war isn't perfect. Maybe it's not going well. Maybe this war wasn't such a good idea. And so I think what's behind really all these complaints is really the United States being very upset, the Bush administration being very upset that the American people are seeing a little, even a tiny slice of what's really going on in Iraq right now.
We have to break for 1 minute, then we'll be back with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, as we continue to bring you Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, our website. And by the way, we are video and audio streaming as we speak all over the country and the world. And we are looking for your comments. What are you doing in this time of war? You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. Stay with us.
women in search of safety, children in need of food, struggling for our freedom. So I am a refugee, women of hope and courage, living through poverty, fleeing from war and terror. So I am a refugee.
Refugee, Pat Humphreys and Sandy Opitow. Here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy, Democracy Now! Correspondent who has been in Iraq four times, just recently returned. In just a minute, we're going to go to Baghdad to speak with one of the only independent reporters left there on the ground, Maying Welsh. But we're with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, talking about POWs and the whole issue of the Geneva Conventions. Another issue that we should just address is international law and the Bush administration in respect to it as they invoke it now. But Michael, we have seen in Nasiriya at this point, five prisoners of war, U.S. soldiers, prisoners of war, have been shown on Al Jazeera. There's video of them. Not clear exactly how many were taken in that situation, another perhaps seven, who it is believed are dead. The questions over the weekend were they killed and then taken, or were they taken and then executed? What is, can you talk a little about this?
Well, obviously, anybody who falls into the custody of one side or another in a war has to be treated humanely. They can't be executed. We don't know whether these people were executed or not. I mean, there's no evidence one way or another. They said they saw a bullet wound in someone's head, but that doesn't mean the person was executed. I mean, that just means that the person is dead and was shot. So it's clearly illegal under international law to execute anybody, just as it's clearly illegal to beat them, to coerce them, even to jail them. You're supposed to intern them basically in a prisoner of war camp and treat them humanely. The question is, what is the United States doing with anybody it's caught, and what are the Iraqis doing? The Iraqis say they will comply. The United States basically has thrown international law out the window. It threw it out the window with the Guantanamo detainees, which it refused to classify as prisoners of war, which refused to give any of the rights under the conventions.
Now, explain that for a minute, this issue of prisoner of war versus enemy combatant, and if they're not classified as prisoner of war, the idea that anything can be done to them.
Well, people picked up on the battlefield are always to be treated as prisoners of war initially. That's where the United States went completely wrong. The United States simply decided we're not going to treat any of the Taliban people in Afghanistan as prisoners of war. We're going to make a new designation called enemy combatants. There's no real law that applies to that because the U.S. makes up the designation. And then it can treat people however it believes it wants. It can put them into a prison camp, an interrogation camp essentially in Guantanamo or in Bagram or Diego Garcia. It can use stress and duress, some people would say, and I would say torture against them. It can do all those kinds of things because it refuses to comply with international law. All of a sudden, you see the U.S. screaming about international law in Geneva. First of all, it's an indication that other countries, if the U.S. doesn't treat people as prisoners of war, why should other countries? And secondly, it's hard for the United States to have any credibility on this issue when the United States was the wholesale violator of the Geneva Conventions during in Guantanamo. And that is, the world was screaming about it. The Red Cross was screaming about it. The High Commissioner at the UN was screaming about it.
We had reporters in this country, one after another, on the networks talking about, well, occasionally the importance of torture when you need to get information out of someone. Could the Iraqis use this argument and say, if they get a soldier that they capture, if they were to torture them, they could get information about where else these soldiers are moving into that might end up killing Iraqi civilians? I mean, that could be the argument that they would make to justify torture.
Right. I mean, obviously, you and I don't want to see anybody in the world tortured for any reason at all, but certainly it puts the United States in a very bad position to actually have used very heavy interrogation techniques, I think, that amount to torture, and then have another country then obviously follow them, and then what can the United States complain about? It's really the demonstration to me of how when you throw out the fundamental protections of international law, you have essentially a lawless world in which people can do what they want to others.
And let me be very clear in the question I asked. I in no way was justifying that treatment of U.S. soldiers or anyone else, but asking if using the logic that the U.S. administration used and why they could engage in torture or abuse of prisoners, could the Iraqi government use that same inhumane argument was my point.
Also, I saw yesterday several networks had attacks on Al Jazeera for having aired these. These were originally images from Iraqi television that many people had access to, many news networks had access to. And the first place I saw them in the U.S. was actually on CBS. Moments after they aired them on CBS this morning, then Dan
that
Rather...
That was this morning, the show Sunday is, morning
yes,
show.
CBS This
morning.
Morning is the name of the show, yeah. Then Dan Rather came on with their special War on Iraq, and he said right off the bat, we are not going to be airing these images. And
but
then
they already had
aired them, and then they said that the Pentagon had told them to not air them, but some of the networks that were then airing the prisoners of war with the blurred faces. But there is, Dan Rather said quite clearly, he said Al Jazeera has violated the Geneva Convention.
Right.
By the way, CNN just aired them a few moments ago.
I was going
to
say, they had a piece on CNN last night, on Sunday night, in which they had three or four journalists arguing about whether they should be aired, but they had basically agreed they should be aired, but tastefully, whatever that meant, or words to that effect. So to the extent you want to condemn Al Jazeera, to the extent you want to do that, you have to condemn, you know, the U.S. media in the same way for basically violating the Geneva Convention.
But are networks violating it? If it comes from Iraqi state television, and then Iraqi state television puts it up on its satellite, and then a network takes it as part of its news story and broadcasts it, is that media outlet violating the Geneva Convention?
I wouldn't think so. That's really the responsibility of the initial violator. After you republish it, so it wouldn't be considered a violation.
Final words, Michael Ratner, on the issue of Geneva Convention.
When I first heard this yesterday, that the U.S. was condemning the treatment of the prisoners of war by the Iraqis, I was utterly shocked. Not just because of the way the Iraqis had put people on TV, but really because of the utter and complete hypocrisy of this country in doing that. And basically a statement that we all said in the Guantanamo cases, this will come back and haunt you guys in the United States. You guys don't know what you're doing here. Even Powell for a while said, I want these people treated under the Geneva Convention as prisoners of war. It has come back to haunt us now. It's terrible. It's incredible to me that the United States should learn a lesson right now and immediately start classifying those people in Guantanamo as prisoners of war and show the world that it can comply with international law.
Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. As we turn now to Baghdad, on Friday, as the massive bombing began, we got in touch with Mei Ying Welsh, who was on the ground in Baghdad. Mei Ying Welsh, an independent reporter, who gave us this description of what was taking place in the Iraqi capital.
Only a few moments ago, I was on the roof of an office building right next to the Tigris River, and I was able to see a gigantic explosion happening in the direction of the Republican Palace. It was so huge, a gigantic mushroom cloud of smoke rose into the sky, and shockwaves came and hit our building so strongly that the whole place shook, and I'm surprised the glass in the windows didn't break. We all started running down the stairs really fast and had to exit the building and run down to the bank of the Tigris. And when we were there, we could see these missiles streaking across the sky. They look like sort of like a light that is... It looks like something very technological, that's all I can say. It looks like a light streaking across the sky, and we saw it hit at some place very far away, but there have been a lot of explosions right around here in this area where there are many ministries, government buildings, and some palaces, and I can definitely say that this night they are trying to take out real centers of power.
Mei Ying, we've seen much of the western side of the Tigris in flames now. We understand that the main presidential compound of Saddam Hussein Presidential Palace has been hit. Can you confirm that?
I can't confirm it to you because I cannot actually go and look at it. It would be too dangerous. I can confirm that it came from that direction. It came from the direction of the Republican palace, which is actually, by the way, a palace which really far predates Saddam Hussein. It's a palace that's been in this country since, I believe, the late 1950s, and it's more a symbol of the Republic of Iraq than necessarily only President Saddam Hussein.
Mei Ying, this is Amy Goodman joining Jeremy. We were just listening to Norman Schwarzkopf saying that he wanted simply to take out the statue of Saddam Hussein, and he wasn't able to do that politically during the Persian Gulf War, that clearly the rules have changed as the massive bombing is now going on with the taking out of the presidential palace in Baghdad. Can you describe for us just what is going on all around you, the kinds of sounds that you're hearing, what people are doing around you, even what time it is right now in Baghdad?
Well, all civilian people are staying in their homes right now. You'd have to be insane or a journalist to be on the streets right now. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of journalists around me running around like crazy. And there are absolutely heart-stopping sounds everywhere around us at all times. I mean, the anti-aircraft fire, there's always the danger that some shrapnel from that can fall on you, and then you never sort of know where the next bomb is going to hit. So it's frankly a pretty frightening experience to be here.
Mei Ying, are you in that same parking lot outside of the Ministry of Information on the western side of Baghdad? Is that where you're speaking to us from right now?
Yes, it is. I'm very close to the Ministry of Information and to the Al-Rashid Hotel, to the Presidential Works Department, to the Shabab Television, which is probably a target. I'm sure it is a target because all night tonight they've been playing music videos, patriotic music videos, people singing odes to Saddam Hussein. Right before this bombing started, Dr. Rahim Al-Muzayed, who's the president of the Iraqi Journalist Union, was on Shabab TV doing a show about President Saddam Hussein and showing a lot of videos of people adoring him. I have no doubt that they want to take out that kind of propaganda while they're at it. So there are quite a number of targets around me, although I would say that I'm relatively safe because I'm also at the same time sort of in the midst of a residential pocket, which is in the midst of all of these ministries and buildings associated with the government. So even though it's pretty frightening to be here, at the same time, I don't think they would hit this place I'm in unless it was by accident.
Mei Ying, yesterday when we spoke to you in Baghdad, you said that journalists had cleared out of the Al-Rashid Hotel, afraid that it would become a target, yet you are right near there. Why would the Al-Rashid Hotel be a target?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and it's something Iraqis always ask me. Why do I think the Al-Rashid is a target? And they always add, is it because of the picture of President Saddam Hussein in the doorway? Because as some of you might know,
President George Bush.
At the front door of the Al-Rashid, there's a picture of Bush. It's a mosaic picture of Bush Sr., President Bush the Sr., and it says on it in English and in Arabic, Bush is criminal. And anyone who enters the hotel has to walk on his face in order to get inside. And so a lot of Iraqis, the sort of rumor on the street is that Bush Jr. wants to hit that hotel because he's angry about the picture of his father. Frankly, I don't think the U.S. would bother to hit the hotel for a reason like that. I don't really know why it could be a target. Perhaps they think it's some kind of central for communications or for some, I don't know, underground bunker network or something like that. I really don't know.
Can you tell at all if these bombs are coming from planes or if they are missiles?
Well, the one that I saw very clearly streaking right across my head was definitely a missile. I don't see planes. You know, sometimes it's really hard to know what's going on up there because you're just seeing so many things lighting up and exploding. It's not clear what anything really is.
The U.S. military is saying that they are going to use depleted uranium weapons, that if war starts, tons of depleted uranium weapons are likely to be used by British and American tanks and by ground aircraft. What are people saying about that right now? How are you protecting yourselves, though that might be at least in the immediate moment, the not your greatest concern?
At the immediate moment, that's not my greatest concern, I have to be honest with you. My greatest concern is that they're going to bomb something very close to me. But, I mean, depleted uranium is an issue which Iraqis have been talking about very loudly and in a very angry and upset way for a long time, and they're really frustrated because they feel that the United Nations has not paid enough attention to what they say are the very high rates of cancer and leukemia and birth defects which have come about ever since the 1991 Gulf War. They do have quite a lot of statistics backing up their case, and they've asked the World Health Organization to come in and do an independent study, but so far that hasn't happened. The idea that depleted uranium could be used in Baghdad, it would definitely be something that would infuriate them, I'm sure, because they feel they are already experiencing the severe effects of something that happened 10 years ago.
You're listening to the voice of Mei Ying Welsh, an independent reporter reporting for Pacifica right now from just outside of the Baghdad Ministry of Information, one of the few independent journalists that is on the ground. We should remind people, it appears as though Operation Shock and Awe has officially begun, according to the Pentagon, massive bombing throughout Baghdad and other parts of the country. Again, Mei Ying Welsh is on the ground, independent reporter.
The news we are getting, Mei Ying, is that in the north of the country, the city of Mosul has been hit by airstrikes, that coalition forces are also moving on Iraq's second city, Basra. Have you heard anything about this?
No, I have not. The only thing I can tell you about Mosul is that Mosul and Anbar are probably the provinces that would stay loyal to this government more than other provinces, perhaps. During the 1991 uprisings that followed the Gulf War, Anbar province, which is the province located right next to Jordan, and also Mosul province, which is obviously the northernmost province of this country, did not participate, did not join in those uprisings. And afterwards, they were dubbed by President Saddam Hussein the white provinces because they stayed so loyal to the government. Basra, on the other hand, today, the Minister of Interior made the unusual admission at a press conference that it might be possible that the U.S. forces could take Basra.
But he said that about Basra, Mei Ying, or Qasr? Did he say that about Basra or Qasr?
Well, he said they might take Qasr, and then he said they might even take Basra, but they'll never take Baghdad. That's what he said.
Just to explain a little bit further to listeners, when Mei Ying is talking about Anbar in the west of Iraq, there are reports that there have been attempts by U.S. forces to move into certain cities in Anbar and that they have been repelled. We're also getting reports that in Nasiriya, U.S. Marines are not able to enter Nasiriya right now because of resistance being put up by Iraqis in Nasiriya.
Mei Ying, Pacifica Radio is going to a news conference in just a minute, but we also wanted to find out from you about any information you have on casualties.
I have no information on casualties at this point. I only know what we knew as of this morning, which was that the official count was 37 civilian casualties. I was able to see a lot of those people in the hospital. I can confirm at least some of them were definitely civilians. I have no idea how many casualties there are now.
Mei Ying, we also heard that some journalists and others are being expelled from Iraq right now. What is happening with journalists?
I really wouldn't know because I'm not anywhere near the Palestine Hotel, which is where most of the journalists are right now. Of course, there are rumors swirling around that CNN is being kicked out and it's different, but I can't confirm any of those rumors. I haven't spoken with CNN myself. I haven't spoken with these people. I don't really know. I can tell you this, that reporting on exact things that have been hit can get you in trouble here. Well, if I were to say, I know for a fact that this particular target was hit at this particular time, that wouldn't be pleasing to the authorities here.
Well, CNN has reported itself that it has been kicked out of Iraq, though we are still hearing Peter Arnett of National Geographic and NBC's voice in Iraq. And again, the latest news we are hearing of the fires raging in Baghdad, as well as the presidential palace being knocked out, being hit by missiles or bombs.
Mei-Ying, I know that in these situations, sometimes it's very difficult to know anything other than what's in your immediate area because of the tightly controlled situation and for your own security. Just so you know, what we're hearing is that U.S. forces are moving rather quickly toward Baghdad right now. They're calling it the Column of Steel, stretching 26 miles, military vehicles moving toward Baghdad. Also, images have been put around the world of Iraqis in Safwan along the border with Kuwait greeting U.S. soldiers, and also hearing that there are U.S. special forces that have been inserted into northern Iraq and western Iraq. Now, all of this is coming from primarily Pentagon sources, so everyone, you know, we have to have a context to it, but just so you're aware, Mei-Ying, of what is happening, that they are saying that they're going to soon reach Baghdad with U.S. forces.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because most Iraqis know about that. Most of them know about these people who turned themselves over and surrendered. They know about the fact that the tanks are sort of headed across the desert here, that they arrived to Nasiriyah. They know about this kind of stuff. They're finding it out off their shortwave radios, and rumor just spreads like crazy. So even though Iraqis aren't getting this information from their media, they know.
Any indication at all, Mei-Ying, that people or the government is preparing to fight when the invading force reaches Baghdad? I know Mohammed Sahaf, the information minister, said that they'll never take Baghdad. Do you see any indication that people are preparing to fight with the Americans, against the Americans?
Well, I can tell you that I've heard from some people who I wouldn't describe as fans of this government that they feel extremely angry to see the American flag being planted anywhere on this soil. It just infuriated them to see a picture of that. I mean, they were saying to me, this is an invasion. This is a real invasion. We didn't invite them to come here and put their flag here. They thought that was just going way too far. And I was also told by these people that they felt that the southern provinces were something really different from them in every way, culturally, as people, the way they think. And they expected, actually, for them to surrender or at least not put up much of a fight. But whereas they consider the northern part of Iraq, Baghdad and Mosul, to be far more likely to put up a resistance.
So
they said they expected this much from the South.
Just so people understand, Mei-Ying is referring to U.S. Marines putting up a flag at Umm Qasr, at the new Umm Qasr in the south of Iraq, one of the main ports used by what was the Oil for Food program, and also one of the main trade ports in Iraq. The United States is now, its forces are now in control of new Umm Qasr. They have not made it into old Umm Qasr, as we now understand. We also are hearing reports that they're moving toward Basra proper itself. I have to say, Mei-Ying, that when I was in Basra over the past several months, when I had gone down there, many people were saying that they did not intend to fight the Americans, that they intended to stay inside of their homes, and that the army was not going to resist. And I think that we're seeing some indications that that is what's playing out outside of Basra. But when the U.S. forces, they have not entered a heavily populated area yet. And I think that we're just going to have to see what happens. The wild card here is, who do people hate more? And I know you know that, Mei-Ying.
Well, yeah, it's actually hard to know sometimes who people hate more. But I mean, I can say that the idea that people could take Basra, that the Americans could take Basra, is not considered surprising here in Baghdad. And the attitude here seems to be, just wait till they get here and see what they find.
Mei-Ying?
I've got to go. I've got to go.
Okay, Mei-Ying, can you just say why you're in Iraq?
Why I'm in Iraq? I guess I'm here because I think this is a really important moment in history and a really important moment for the Arab world, and most importantly to me, a really important moment for the United States. I see my country changing after September 11th into a country which is very much going out into the world with its military forces in a way that may be a violation of our own principles and of international law. And I'm concerned about that, and I want to see it with my own eyes. I want to judge for myself whether or not I think what we're doing is right. And I think the most important thing is to be here, because if I were, for instance, with the troops themselves, I wouldn't know how the people that we are fighting against, we say we're fighting for, feel about all of this. And that's my goal here, is to try and find out how they really feel. I'll tell you, it's been a really hard job, because a lot of people here are afraid to talk, but I feel that it's worth it to try and to try and see how the people of this city and of this country are seeing us.
Mei Ying, are there any circumstances under which you would leave?
No.
Right now, are you taking precautions to protect yourself? Do you know where you can go to protect yourself?
Yes, I do have a place I can go, a residential location that I can get to, which I feel I would be safe in, as safe as one could be in these conditions. I mean, if things got to a really dangerous point, at that point, I don't think it would be possible to move very much. So, I mean, there probably is a moment when I would leave. I mean, certainly when I saw the huge explosion that was created by blowing up some of those buildings very close to us, actually it was so mesmerizing, I was shocked, and it didn't occur to me to flee. But then some people around me said, get down, you know, and that's when everybody started running out of the building. I mean, sometimes when you realize things are too dangerous, it's too late.
Mei Ying Welsh, independent reporter on the ground in Baghdad, Iraq. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, the protests. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill as we continue to bring you reports from the front and around the world as protests mount along with the casualty count. And last night, as we were continuing to hearing reports of fighting raging in Iraq, the Oscars were going on in Los Angeles. The 75th Annual Academy Awards Ceremony. in our other hour of our special expanded editions of Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, we'll hear what documentary filmmaker Michael Moore had to say as he won the Best Feature-Length Documentary, giving a scathing speech against the war and against President Bush. And we'll hear from some of the other presenters and winners. But right now, we're going to turn to a man who is not at the Oscars, but was on the streets in New York on Saturday, when hundreds of thousands of people marched for more than 40 blocks, for more than 4 hours, taking over the area from the Armed Forces Recruiting Station at Times Square down to Washington Square. He was longtime activist and actor Ozzie Davis.
Of this country with the democratic responsibility, you know, to speak out, even if what I say is unpopular. Now, those in our craft and profession who follow the path of celebrity, whose every word or every move is dictated about how it's going to look in the ratings, you know, may have another way to respond to the calls of citizenship. But I am not concerned about that. They tell me that supporting President Bush is patriotic. Well, I would say that a deeper patriotism is required when we consider to whom we owe our patriotic response. Nobody is more concerned for the welfare of the young men and women who are fighting overseas. I want them home so much that I'm out here today saying, peace, peace, stop, bring them home. That to me is patriotism. Mr. Bush has his point of view and his right to express it, and I have mine. On this, we disagree, and it's my patriotic right and responsibility to tell Mr. Bush, who works for me, who spends my tax dollars, that not in my name will you do this.
Ozzie Davis, you're wearing a cap that says USS Mason. What is that?
This is a cap representing the only ship in World War II that was manned by black personnel. I didn't know when I fought in World War II that the Navy even allowed black folks to fight independently in one ship. The USS Mason was that ship. So we were doing a documentary about it, and they were kind enough to give me this hat. So in their name and in their honor, as veterans of World War II, I'm wearing this hat.
And you're there's a veteran, a discussion. Davis, you're a veteran?
Oh, am I a veteran? Oh, yes, I am. I remember in World War II, sitting one day, August 7th, 1945, and realizing that the bomb that had been dropped on Hiroshima not only killed 220,000 people over there, but part of it fell on me too. And I recognized that something cataclysmic had happened, an earthquake in my world and in my thoughts had taken place. And it called on me to make a choice. I didn't know it at the time, but somebody finally said, the choice is to live together as brothers or perish together as fools. I come today to say, I choose to live for brotherhood and not for folly. I choose peace and not war. I choose life and not death.
Does the term shock and awe bring memories back of that time?
Yes, it does. It also brings memories of what happens after shock and awe. It's the disorientation and the depression, the dislocation of the human spirit is something, you know, that we wear and bear forever. To go into a city and shock them with the power of our bombs into awe and to submission, to me, is not a sign of bravery. It is rather a sign of bullying. We have this tremendous power, and we exercise it at its full against people who have no quarrel with us, mothers, children, dogs, cats, all life can be obliterated by what we do. Shock, yes. Awe, yes. How close do we come to the end of all civilization? when we do these things. Oh, yes, I'm shocked and I stand in awe of the possibility of the destruction which might include me and mine.
As the bombs rain down on Baghdad, the Academy Awards are going to go on. There's been discussion of a blacklist of actors who are speaking out against war, and some who might even use the Academy Awards as a platform to discuss their views. What are your thoughts about that as an actor?
Well, in the first place, I confess that I've never taken the Academy Awards very seriously. It's an exercise in salesmanship and hype and little more. I do understand its importance to those who participate, and I can empathize or sympathize with those who think that they must say yes and be innocuous in order to be loved. I'm sorry that they feel this way, because it is not true. I don't think an Academy Award, I don't think being a celebrity or being anything else overrides the responsibility to be a decent, humane citizen, fighting like hell to save the possibility of the continued existence of life on this planet.
Ozzie Davis speaking as he prepared to march on Saturday, one of the thousands of marches around the world against war. As we go now to the end of that march that he began on Saturday in New York, hundreds of thousands of people march, many believe more than 500,000 people, perhaps more than that, in New York alone. After marching for 30 blocks, protesters were greeted by a white police van parked in Washington Square Park. It blared over and over a recorded message telling people to leave. Then as protesters milled around, police in riot gear marched toward them in formation and tried to clear the streets. People responded by pulling together defiantly and sitting down in the street.
The march is now over. Please leave the area in an orderly fashion so that other marchers may complete their march as you have done. Thank you.
The war is now over. Please leave Iraq immediately.
The war is now over. Please leave Iraq immediately.
My name is Francisco Chavez, and I'm here because my family was forced to leave El Salvador back in the 1970s due to the repression of that government, which was backed by the United States. And now that we have lived in New York for more than 30 years, we're not going to move back.
My name is Harriet Silver, and when the police were pushing people down, just standing abreast, and my instinct was to go face them and see what they would do with a white-haired old lady, you know? And we started a chant that peace is for your children, too. And, you know, we shouted that, and they stopped, you know? So.
Some of the sounds of protest recorded by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. For those staying with us, stay. This is Democracy Now!